Hello, this is Don McPherson, your host of 12 Geniuses. Today's guest is Dr. Matthew Johnson. Dr. Johnson joined us in Season 3 to talk about the future of psychedelics. He is Senior Investigator in Psychedelics at Sheppard Pratt and Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Johns Hopkins University, where he is one of the world's most published scientists on the human effects of psychedelics. Dr. Johnson and I talk about the advancements in psychedelic research that have been made in the last few years, how favorable public opinion about these once taboo drugs continues to grow, and we close the conversation with Dr. Johnson's sobering advice for people who are experimenting on their own with these drugs, going on weekend psychedelic retreats, or even going to South America to have ayahuasca experiences with the shaman. This episode of 12 Geniuses is brought to you by The Star Conspiracy. The Star Conspiracy is the B2B marketing agency for innovative brands creating the future of workplace solutions. For more information, head over to thestarconspiracy.com. Matt, welcome back to 12 Geniuses.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
I'm excited to have this conversation. You were a guest back in September of 2020. We talked about the future of psychedelics. And an incredible amount has happened in that 3.5-4 years. So maybe you could just update us on the research advances in the field of psychedelics.
Yeah, so probably the most exciting thing is that we may be within 6 months of MDMA being approved for PTSD. So about a month ago, the FDA formally accepted the IND package, the application for MAPS, or now Lykos, their public benefit corporation that they spun into, for the MDMA for PTSD work. And so what that means is that they're not going to come back and say they want, you know, more research that's going to cost millions of dollars. They're going to evaluate, make a decision based upon the data that has been brought to bear. And so they conducted 2 phase 3 clinical trials, which looked very good. So the research has been published, and, you know, a continuation of their previous research, high rates of remission, clinically significant results. And so you know, we have to wait for the FDA decision. We're probably 5 months or so away from the FDA saying, yes, you know, MDMA is approved for clinical use outside of, you know, clinical trials. Now there's going to likely be, you know, special rules, a REMS program, which is kind of FDA lingo for these special rules that need to be applied when conducting an approved therapy. But yeah, so that's probably going to see the expansion. You know, a lot of people are probably going to receive MDMA therapy, not nearly as many people who could probably potentially benefit, but at least compared to the people, you know, legally receiving that therapy now in these clinical trials, it's going to massively expand, relatively speaking. And then probably the other big thing in the field has been the movement forward in the work using psilocybin for depression. So, you know, the most important finding in the field was the largest study ever conducted with psilocybin, a 233-person study of psilocybin, 2 different doses, really 3 different doses, sort of a trivial dose, but compared to a moderate dose, and then a relatively high dose for depression, and consistent with previous findings, some pretty long-standing reductions in depression that were seen in a dose-dependent fashion. So with the best results seen with the highest dose. So, you know, those were phase 2 results. So multiple sponsors are moving forward into phase 3, which is the final phase that you need for potential FDA approval. So, you know, MDMA is likely to beat psilocybin to the punch in terms of clinical approval. But, you know, we may be, depending on phase 3 results, we may be within, you know, 2 or 3 years, maybe 2 on the optimistic side, but a few years away from approval of psilocybin psilocybin for depression, major depressive disorder. And the work with addiction has continued. There was a large phase two, almost 100-person study of psilocybin for alcohol use disorder that was published that looked very promising, with some biological verification of in a subset of participants, backing up reports with the substantial reduction in the number of days that people were drinking. This was in a placebo-controlled trial. And then I recently finished up the 6 months data for the psilocybin for smoking cessation research, which looked very promising as well. So stay tuned for those results to be published.
Hopping back to MDMA and using it for PTSD, who would be the first group of people, or who's in line to use this first once it is approved by the FDA?
I'm not sure whether it's going to be restricted to treatment-resistant individuals. In other words, people that have tried, you know, something for addressing their PTSD or not. I would imagine that could be the case. However, there's certainly plenty of folks who have tried, be it one of the SSRIs or one of the psychotherapies for PTSD, which there tends to be a pretty high dropout rate from those therapies. So it's PTSD. So from any number of sources, be it combat veterans to, sexual assault survivors, to really any other source of PTSD.
Okay. I would imagine there are many, many people who would benefit from that. And so my question was really around, how do you select from this great pool of people who would want that sort of treatment?
Well, we'll see. Of course, the thing that is going to be in place is that, not everyone who may be interested would qualify. So there's probably going to be, and I hope there's, reasonable rules in place, people who might be at elevated cardiovascular risk wouldn't be appropriate participants. And the field is still erring on the side of, people at this point in time who have a recognizable predisposition for disorders like schizophrenia. People without those levels of risk, but to some degree, things will open up. There'll probably be more individuals with comorbid, disorders, I would imagine, for example, substance use, which is certainly, many people, whether it's alcohol or other addictive substance, oftentimes there's self-medication in PTSD patients. So it'll be in, hopefully there'll be the right balance of maintaining the exclusions that are really important for, keeping people safe, but yet allowing the more variability in people that maybe weren't able to access the clinical trials and starting to learn something from that more kind of realistic sample of people in treatment. And that's the way, that's just the general trajectory of as treatments move outside of research and into clinical dissemination, you're going to get messier samples, scientifically speaking. And so you start to see what things look like in reality.
I just wonder how popular opinion has shifted. And then we can get into regulations and laws, because legally it doesn't seem like a lot of states or even cities are legalizing it. But I'm curious to start with popular opinion in the U.S.
Yeah, popular opinion has shifted quite a bit. I think really, a big part of that has been this kind of growing, or at least moving along with that, is the very large growth of a psychedelic medicines industry, dozens of companies with their eye towards FDA approval of these medicines, many of which now have novel compounds that they're looking moving through the pathway, and continued positive media. I would say, if anything, sometimes there's things are a bit too enthusiastic. You get concerned when really things are portrayed as a cure-all and the idea that everyone's going to be helped, which is not going to be the case. And there is a concerning sort of creep of psychedelic evangelism, where it really seems that science isn't the thing guiding us, and that it's sort of this kind of mission to, that psychedelics are going to save humanity. That's a very concerning kind of twist on this field, because, those types of visions inevitably lead to harms. This sort of ends justifies the means mentality. And so there's been a lot of hype. And so I think it's important to have the right balance between, hey, it looks like there's a lot of potential here. This could potentially help a lot of people who aren't currently being helped now, but nothing's going to help everybody. Not everyone should be doing psychedelics. There are real risks that shouldn't be trivialized. And we shouldn't be, there's a strong tendency towards the guru worship, this sort of deification of the figures in the psychedelic world, and that's really dangerous. There's a lot of egos, a lot of narcissism, a lot of I think people enjoying that type of that type of opinion. And I think we just have to really keep ourselves grounded, and to the degree we can, work together towards making these, going through the relevant pathways to make these available in the right way to the right people. And particularly on the sort of the metaphysical, the spiritual realms, it's going to be a bit of a challenge. I think one of the biggest challenges is that we really just need to mainstream this in a way where you can provide very, very human treatment. You can support people. You can have extremely inviting environments, positive settings. But when it comes to flavoring metaphysical and supernatural beliefs, I think we need to really strongly stay away from that and let the patients, make any decisions they want to there, make any interpretations that they want to, and we're not there to correct them and impose materialism or anything like that. But it's really going to be critical that we let the patient drive the bus in terms of any spiritual interpretation. And by that, I mean metaphysical, supernatural, whether it's, that, Jesus spoke to their heart, or whether it's plant spirits, or whether the person has a Muslim interpretation, or they have a completely atheist, interpretation of sort of the psychedelic experience, all of that is welcome, but let the patient drive the bus when it comes to any of that, because I really see the big dangers here is this guru complex that's developing surrounding the use of these psychedelics.
Well, the last area that I wanted to touch on is if you have any words of caution for weekend retreaters. And I bring this up because many of my friends have experimented, have gone on with retreats, have gone down to Peru and been on these ayahuasca retreats. And when I hear about some of these experiences, they, some of them sound amazing, but some of them I'm like, whoa, what are you doing? Where are you going? How are you, verifying that these people are credentialed? So I'm curious to know what words of caution you have for folks who may want to have some sort of experience like this.
Yeah, so I certainly am very careful always to say I don't encourage the use of psychedelics or any other compound. I mean, even caffeine, however, I'm happy to tell people what we know scientifically about what separates riskier from less risky use. And certainly if someone is going to use, there are a number of things that's going to, make things safer, relatively speaking, knowing something about the people that are going to be around them. I mean, this is best done without strangers and in a situation where there's some rapport that has built up between the people that are going to be helping them through it. Hopefully those people aren't intoxicated themselves on the substance or anything else. There should be something known about the substance, the identity of the substance they're taking, and about the dose that they're taking. People are even though something like psilocybin is relatively safe at the bodily level, there are exceptions. It does raise blood pressure. People at high risk for cardiovascular disease can be harmed, even could die. I mean, there are examples of it. They are admittedly rare, but people can potentially die through, I mean, these are people in the category that, shoveling snow or other, daily, going up flights of stairs could push them over the edge and prompt an event if they're, susceptible. So having a physical, including knowing their cardiovascular status and risk, would be, someone who knows that they're not at cardiovascular risk, is going to be, relatively speaking, less at risk than someone who hasn't had that evaluation. Doses, all else being equal, lower doses are less risky than higher doses, even having the ability to judge what that dose is. Some eye towards looking at what medications that they're on, including ones that may have interactions with whatever compound they're looking to take, making sure that they're monitored during the entire time. And then just, trusting, I think I already mentioned this, but it's worth this extra mention, really what is known, especially when someone's flying off to go to a retreat, what is known about the individuals, I mean, there are reports of, sexual assault and other, and just, poor clinical care, being left alone during times of crisis, this type of thing, during psychedelic experiences. So there's a whole lot, and nothing I say could be an exhaustive list, but one would be well advised, if they're, doing something like this, to know as absolutely as much as possible, to do as much homework as they can, and to have as many factors in place to be on the less risky side rather than the more risky side. Mm-hmm. But again, there are dangers. There are dangers even if one maximizes all of those things. So it's not like I'm recommending it.
No, I understand. I think it's really good advice. And, just one comment on the popular opinion side of things. I might have mentioned to you when we talked in 2020 that I'm on the board of a drug and alcohol treatment facility. And I've been on the board for about 5 years. One of the first meetings that we had that I was involved with, I had mentioned psychedelics as a potential tool for treatment, and the rest of the board members just shut it down, had no interest in having that conversation. That was about 2020, maybe 2019.
Yeah.
And then since then, almost every board meeting, big board meeting, annual retreat that we have, we talk about psychedelics and the advancements that have been made. And so I have found that to be really interesting, because most of the board members have gone through treatment. I have not. So they're 12-steppers, they're abstinence only, but they've even opened up to this. And I thought that was kind of interesting to see that shift among that population of people. And I wonder if you want to comment on that.
Yeah, that's certainly reflective of where we are at as a culture. It seems to be these conversations are happening everywhere. And so people are open to the potential, you know, just again, advise that people, you know, recognize. I mean, there is some concern that, I mean, maybe there, you know, some of the initial concerns, even if they weren't completely balanced and if they weren't open to the evidence of and the potential of using these things in a balanced way. I mean, there may be kernels of truth to some of their initial concerns. I mean, it does appear to be the case that some people are using, even though psychedelics, the classic psychedelics like psilocybin or ayahuasca, don't appear to be addictive in the classical sense. I mean, people getting into daily use habits where they, you know, can't control their own use despite their best wishes. Nonetheless, there are folks clinically that looks like they're doing a lot of psychedelics and it's not necessarily good for them. It may be bad for them. So we're still yet to figure out things about the potentially negative effects on personality. I mean, there are certainly anecdotal cases, like most people who have been around psychedelics and psychedelic, you know, various psychedelic communities will say, yeah, there's some people that, you know, are personality disordered, and it's, you know, appears that, you know, the psychedelics may have, one, attracted extreme people, but then also perhaps made people worse. People can become quite frankly obsessed with psychedelics as the thing that like defines all of reality, and, you know, kind of have an unbalanced relationship. So, you know, in moving forward, like openness is good, but also, you know, wisdom. I would say, you know, one of the big lessons in this field is that psychedelic experience, epiphanies, they never replace wisdom of sort of, you know, the wisdom of ethics, the wisdom of understanding boundaries in life, understanding, you know, going about, you know, balancing the right degree of openness and the right degree of protection. You know, it's kind of at play with everything. You know, how much do you protect your kids versus not overprotecting them? You know, in terms of personal health decisions, you know, you don't want to, you know, you might be safest locking yourself inside, you know, and never doing anything, never driving, you know, never, you know, taking any risk, but obviously that's not optimal. So, you know, I'd say a similar, you know, kind of balance is necessary here in the psychedelic realm. And so we have to be cautious not to go too far to the side of that, you know, psychedelics are going to save everything and that, you know, that they can do no harm.
It's not a panacea.
It's not a panacea, right?
Well, it's really exciting, the progress that's being made. I really want to thank you again for being a part of 12 Geniuses. Thank you for your time, and thank you for being a genius.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Thank you for listening to 12 Geniuses, and thanks to the Star Conspiracy for sponsoring this week's show. We will be back next week with another episode exploring the trends shaping the way we live and work. Thanks for listening. And thank you for being a genius.